We're joined again by people at church, which is nice.
You can see him looking at.
Don't know where they can hear us, but hello everyone in church. Well, this morning we are going to continue with our series on Moses. So we're going to continue with the story of Moses. We have, of course, looked at his growing up away from Egypt and coming back to Egypt, and then all the plagues that happened, and then the Passover as the people of Israel came out of Egypt, and then the crossing of the Red Sea and the giving of the Ten Commandments. And we're moving on now to another section, which is called the Golden Calf. We're going to watch a clip of DVD that sums up this passage, but if you wanted to look at it in the Bible, it is Exodus chapters 32 and 33, but we're going to sum it up in this short DVD. Summing up of the story of the golden calf, which we get onto after all the other things that have happened to Moses and the people of Israel so far. And we're going to think about that just for a few minutes. But we have got a challenge if you are interested in doing something while you're listening. And the challenge is, I feel it's a bit weak today, I'm sorry, but the challenge is to depict the story of the golden calf in whatever way you would like. So it could be in the style of a famous artist or a famous period in art history. So to depict the story of the golden calf in a picture, but in the style of a particular artist that you like or a time of art history that you enjoy. Does that make sense? If you know nothing about art, just like depict it however you want. Modern style. And you can do that while we're listening to some thoughts. We had that quiz, didn't we, about sporting failures, if you like. People who were nearly victorious and then it all went terribly wrong. And there was one person who I remember when I was growing up. Now, I'm not particularly into golf, I'd just like to say, but I did watch it occasionally. And there was one person called Jean van der Velde. I don't know whether anyone remembers that name, but he played in the 1999 Open Championship. And the reason I remember this is because Jean van der Velde led by 3 strokes at the final tee, which means, if you're not into golf, that you could make 3 horrendous mistakes and still win because you were 3 strokes ahead of him. And all he had to do was to play the 18th hole as he'd played it for the whole of the week, just straightforward, get the putt in and win the championship. That's all he had to do. But the first shot he took, for some reason, missed the 18th altogether and landed near the 17th hole. That was his first error. But never mind, he could still play it. So he went over and he took his second shot, which inexplicably hit the grandstand where everyone was sitting and landed in thick, rough grass. The third shot that he hit could have landed on the fairway and been fine, but accidentally he made a bad shot and it went into the water. He then took his socks and shoes off and got into the water and stood there debating whether to take the shot from the water, but decided that would be a foolish idea. So they took the ball out and put it onto the grass, which meant that he dropped another shot. So his fifth shot, which could have gone on the green, went into a bunker, a sandbar, in front of the green. His sixth shot, however, did land 6 feet away from the hole. And people were debating, would he get it in or not? If he got it in, then he would enter into a playoff with 3 other players and he could still win the championship. And he did get it in. So he entered into a playoff, but he eventually lost that. So he didn't win the championship. But you know, when Jean van der Velde had stood on the 18th tee at the beginning of the last hole, he was all but guaranteed victory. He had played over that weekend 71 holes of golf. And was 3 shots ahead of everyone else, which is quite a long way. He'd done all the hard work and he had victory in his grasp. But then a series of bad choices, stressful moments, wrong shots led to the most unbelievable defeat remembered 21 years later, when Jean van der Velde is known not for taking his chances and winning the championship, but rather for grasping defeat from the jaws of victory. A little bit like all the other sports people and horses and teams that we saw in our quiz a few moments ago. And also, strangely, a bit like the Israelites in our story today. A people who, up until now, with the odd hiccup here and there, had worked their way towards victory. They played, if you like, 71 holes, where they had gone from slaves in Egypt, unnamed and unknown, to the people of God being moulded and shaped by him in the wilderness. And during this time, they'd come through captivity and plague and miraculous seas that parted before them. And they'd been given water and food and rules to live by in the wilderness. And now they were on the verge of becoming a people named and led by God himself, who everyone would know. They were on the verge of a most unlikely victory, if you like. And all they had to do at this point in which we join them today in our story is wait. They'd been given the Ten Commandments. They had seen Moses and Joshua go up the mountain to meet with God again. They knew that Moses would be receiving more instructions that would shape and guide them for the future. And all they had to do was wait. Wait for Moses to come down and tell them the next steps. And yet, as they stood in the wilderness, as they stood on the 18th tee, if you like, and as they considered what was ahead, they did what can only be described as a Jean Vandervelde. They snatched defeat from the jaws of victory by worshipping a golden calf. And, you know, in some ways, I guess I can understand why they might have done this. In some ways, I can understand why the golden calf came to be. Because if we think about it, from the point that the people of God left Egypt, they had always been led. They had been led by Moses and they had been led by God. They'd had the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. And Moses had been there to answer their problems and to plead on their behalf when they'd made mistakes. But now, as they stood in the wilderness and waited, Moses was gone. He'd gone up the mountain with God. And the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire was also gone up the mountain. And they were left in the wilderness waiting. And it's not like they were left for a couple of days or maybe a week. They were left for 40 days and 40 nights on their own, wondering what to do, wondering if Moses had gone or if God had left them for good or if they would ever see either of them again. And so quite naturally, they decided they needed to make a few decisions of their own. And so they go to Aaron, the second in command, and they say, "Come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him." They went to Aaron and they asked for him to do something. And Aaron, wanting to help the people of God, makes the golden calf. Not, it seems, as a replacement for God, but more as guidance for them as they wait for Moses to return. But the people of God, a people desperately in search of guidance and hope, make the terrible decision to worship this replacement, declaring of the golden calf, "These are your gods, Israel, who brought you out of Egypt." Now Aaron, all credit to him, seeing what the people do with the calf, tries to make things right by building an altar to God in front of the calf and declaring a festival to the Lord. But it's too late, because at the heart of it, the people of God have already violated the first and second commandments that they were given. They've replaced God and attributed his accomplishments to someone else. And Aaron, like Jean Vandervelde, had made a decision that leads to disastrous consequences. I don't know whether anyone's into Bear Grylls or any of the things that he does. We quite like to watch Bear Grylls here in our house because, you know, it's fun. He's got this program and it's called You Versus the Wild. I don't know whether anyone's ever seen it. But basically, it's one of these programs where you watch it for a bit and then Bear will give you a choice about what you could do. So he'll do some activities in the wild and then he'll stand there and go, I've got a problem. I could either swing across this crevasse on a rope, or I could climb down and see what's down there. What do you think? And then you get to choose. So you've got the remote control and you get to press which choice you want. And obviously Bear Grylls has filmed all possibilities. And so you decide, and either you succeed or you fail. So Bear will stand there and go, I'm a bit hungry. Do I want to eat this camel poo that's in front of me? Or do I want to continue to search for some more nutrients? And so you decide what he does. And he actually does each of them. So he must have actually eaten the camel sting. But anyway, and whatever you decide to do decides whether the program ends at that point and you go back to the beginning, or whether you continue on in the journey with Bear Grylls, or if you like, whether you succeed or fail. The choice is yours. And you know, here, Aaron and the people of God had a choice to make. And they made their choice to worship the golden calf. They failed, if you like. Not, I believe, out of a deliberate determination to replace God with and Moses, but rather out of fear. They were afraid that God had gone. They were afraid that their leader had deserted them. They were afraid that they were on their own. And so they chose to take life into their own hands. And they made what we now know to be a disastrous decision. And in all fairness, they're not on their own in this, because mistakes like this can be so easy to do, can't they? Especially when people are feeling unsure. John van der Velde knew this. Aaron knew this. And, you know, we can know it too as well, can't we? Because at some point or other, we've all felt the same. We've all done the same. We've all felt lost and a little bit alone and feeling we need to do something to make things better. People the world over know how this feels, especially today in our climate, where, to be honest, good leadership seems a little bit sparse, where isolation is widespread and where people feel that God has gone a bit silent. And so decisions are made to take things into our own hands to make it better. And, you know, sometimes this works out okay, but more often than not, it results in God being replaced and his accomplishments being attributed to someone else. It results in disastrous consequences, when actually 9 times out of 10, what we are called to do is what the Israelites were called to do, to wait faithfully to God. So that instead of desperately searching around for solutions to problems we cannot solve, we take a breath and we trust the God who has called us and the God who cares for us. So that's what we're going to do right now. We're going to pause for a moment and take a breath. Maybe think about the things that we've faced, maybe decisions that we've made sometimes that have not resulted in things we would want. Maybe the times we've tried to take life into our own hands. We're just going to pause before God and take a breath, be still before him and think things through and offer ourselves back to God. We're going to do this by listening to a song, and hopefully there'll be a slide that appears on the screen if you'd like to look at that and focus. Or if you'd like to just sit and think while you listen, then please do. We're just going to take a few. Now, of course, the consequences of the golden calf didn't end when Moses was up the mountain with God. Moses, as we read, came down and brought his own punishments. And God struck the people with a plague as well. Devastating consequences, which we can struggle to understand when we read it today. Probably here in the book of Exodus, so that its readers would recognise the seriousness of what the people of Israel had done. But in all honesty, the consequences could have been far, far worse, because when God realised what the people were doing in worshipping something other than him, he contemplated destroying them completely and starting again with Moses to create a new nation. God said, I have seen these people and they are a stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. God asked Moses to leave him, to go down the mountain so that he could decide the fate of the people he had brought out of Egypt. God asked Moses to go from his presence. But surprisingly, instead of leaving, Moses stays. In fact, he refuses to go, and instead he challenges God. He says, why should your anger burn against your people who you brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Turn from your fierce anger and relent, and do not bring disaster on your people. Moses stays, and not only that, but he argues the case with God. He points out what other nations will think if God destroys the Israelites. He asks God to remember his promises of the past. He reminds God of what he has already done for these people. And God relents, or if you like, God changes his mind. He does not destroy Israel, but instead he allows them to live and have the future he desired for them all along. And God does this firstly because he is a God of love. He is a faithful God. He is a God who always desires salvation above anything else. And secondly, he does this because Moses refuses to be quiet. He refuses to leave God alone. Or to be more accurate, God changes his mind because Moses decides to get involved with God's plan. And the interesting thing about this is that when Moses gets involved, when Moses prays, if you like, and asks and reasons with God, God listens. In fact, not only does he listen, but he's open to Moses' suggestions. He hears what Moses has to say. He takes what Moses contributes with utmost seriousness, and he reconsiders. God doesn't make Moses beg and bargain and offer ridiculous promises in return. Instead, God invites Moses' contribution. And on the basis of what Moses said, God changes his mind. He doesn't change his nature, but he changes his mind to come into line with his nature. And because of Moses, once again, the people of God are able to live a different future to what they would have done if Moses had kept quiet and walked away. And, you know, as we consider what it is to be the people of God today in our circumstances and in these strange times, and as we see the example of the Israelites, and particularly of Moses, we'd be wise to ponder Moses' actions here and the change in God because of his interaction with a human being. recognizing the fact that although God is almighty, and although he is everlasting, and although he is unchangeable in character, God is not a dictator. And what's more, as we wait faithfully for him, he calls us to be involved. In fact, he invites us to play our part, not only in actions towards other people, but in an invitation to come to his throne of grace, not just to receive, but also to contribute into the work he's doing. Not as minions who may be heard if they shout loud enough or bargain long enough or live good enough lives, but as partners and friends, as dearly beloved children. And if we do this, if we dare to get involved with God on this level of prayer, we, like Moses, may be part of shaping a future that bears the hallmarks of God's grace rather than the deserved consequence of human sin. Because at the end of the day, God's decisions will always be able to change if it allows him to have an ongoing relationship with those he has created. So it's a challenge for us, I guess, in our prayer life. How do we see the prayers that we offer to God, and how do we see the relationship we have with him? And it's been good to see everyone in church. It's good to see you again. I'm glad that you could join us. And I think in a moment, we're going to break into our group to have a chat and discussion, and hopefully people join us next week for no longer breakfast service, just service.